Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. Tonight, I wanted to talk about the joining of two topics, relational mindfulness and wise communication. I've been struggling today to prepare this talk. I think the reason is because what I'm needing the most in my life right now is like social interaction, and I have very little of it because I just had a baby a couple months ago. And we're still figuring out how to integrate old life and new life. And so it's funny, I sat down to prepare the talk, and I was thinking about communication. I was like, I don't even know what it's like to like be around people, and what is it like to communicate? You know, I was trying to feel into that social self that feels quite muted at the moment. And so I got like super heady into talking about like phenomenological existence and like crazy shit. Y'all, I did it for like 3 hours and I thought it was really good, and then I looked over it and I was like, this is insanity. I'm not going to talk about this tonight. So fortunately, I post the topic on Instagram because I stuck to this topic, or you would have gotten a talk on phenomenological existence and don't know how helpful that would have been. So oftentimes when the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path, he would teach people to start practicing their spiritual path by looking at their ethical behavior. This is what we call the practice of sila, which is in the Eightfold Path comprised of three things: speech, action, and livelihood. Bringing awareness to the ways in which we communicate, into the ways in which we behave, in the ways in which we earn a living in our lives. And the reason I think the Buddha started with this teaching on sila is because it's really hard to develop ease and peace in life without looking at how our happiness really comes so much from lining up our actions with what we value, right? So in AA, they have a phrase for this. They say you can't think your way into right acting. You have to act your way into right thinking. It's also the basis of behavioral psychology, that if you want to feel good, you have to do things you feel good about, right? And this is really pretty smart. I think 2,600 years ago for the Buddha to have this awareness that if you want to feel good, the first thing you should do is start doing things you feel good about. It's funny because in the West, we start with mindfulness. We say, well, I'm just going to observe my thoughts, let them come and go, and when my mind wanders off, tell the mind not right now and focus back on my breath. But we don't realize that so much of our mind wandering, the obsessive, self-critical, harsh, negative self-talk in our mind comes from what we do. If we live busy and restless lives, we have busy and restless minds. Right? So the ways in which we talk, the ways in which we act, and what we do for work, right? We spend so much time in these behaviors. If we can start just bringing a little bit more awareness to these areas of our lives, it has a profound effect on our mind. So from a Buddhist perspective, happiness is a collection of good habits. It's not an enlightened state of mind. It's dharma, really what the Buddha taught. The dharma is a behavior. It's a verb, it's not a noun. happiness is kind of like that. It's a verb. It's not a noun. It's not a state. It's not a place. It's not even an emotion. Right? I think what we're talking about here is really contentment. Or what we have in Buddhism is this word equanimity. Equanimity is really, it's a practice. How do we learn to practice seeing clearly and responding wisely to the conditions of the present experience? It really boils down to that. That's the Dharma as a behavior. How do I see clearly and respond wisely to this present experience? The central principle of practicing around ethics, sometimes it's called morality. I just like the word integrity, living with integrity or with values. The central principle is the value of non-harming. Right. And so looking at how in the many forms that harm takes in our lives, not just harm to others, but harm on the level of what's harmful, what's skillful or unskillful for ourselves and our well-being, what's skillful and unskillful for our society, what's skillful and unskillful in our relationships to others. Right? There's so many levels of this. We think about meditation as a inward practice. The word actually in Pali Sanskrit is opanayako, which means to look inwardly or to bring inside oneself. And this is what contemplative practice is all about, is to look at the mind. But the Buddha, the way that he taught it in this 2600-year-old discourse called the Satipatthana Sutta, he says to practice mindfulness internally and to practice mindfulness externally. And then he says to practice mindfulness internally and externally. So we're looking at the interrelationship between our thoughts, our speech, our action, and our environments, and the relationship that our environment has on our mind, on our emotional experience, on our reactions. Sometimes I refer to this as the relational field, right? Every moment of conscious awareness is a relationship. We're always in relationship with something. In this moment, we're in relationship with the words coming out of my mouth, with your own inner dialogue, with the sounds moving by, with the felt experience in the body. There's a lot of things to relate to in this present experience. This is the Buddhist teaching on dependent co-arising, which I won't get into, but the fact that making contact with some things, being aware of some things in our present experience, leads to other things. Simple example, you're driving down the road, you see a car, reminds you of someone you used to know, you start thinking about that person, you start feeling the resentment towards that person. Then you start thinking about this other person that you and that person used to hang out with. And then you think about that group of friends and how you don't talk to them anymore. And then you feel sad and lonely. And then your partner calls and then you get all agitated and upset with them. Why don't we go out anymore? Why don't we have friends? So you see, just a thought, just a sight of a car really led to the arising of all these other experiences. And so there's this other principle that we need to think about in terms of morality or living with our values in mind, and that's the principle of karma. Now, in our Western pop culture idea of karma, we sometimes think of karma as this kind of merit bank of behavior. Whatever you do comes back equal at some undisclosed period in the future. And the way that the Buddha taught karma was drastically different than that perspective. The perspective I just mentioned was the perspective at the time of the Buddha's life, this kind of linear deterministic type of karma. But the Buddha refocused the purpose of karma being on your intention. Our motivations behind our actions, right? That whatever you practice, you get better at, and that your motivation is really the tipping point of what you're practicing. So the way that he says this in one of the suttas is, whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of your mind. Right? These motivations are like our silent agents of our behavior. Before we do anything, we have a movement of the mind. The Pali Sanskrit word for this is chetana, which means... Good, I erased it from here. That was the other talk. Chetana basically means a movement of the mind to do something. Sally Armstrong, a Dharma teacher that I'm quite fond of, calls it the about-to moment. Right? You know the moment where you're about to do something? The Buddha says, that's a very fucking important moment. He said, because what you do in the about-to moment can become habituated. Without you even knowing it, you about to do something, then you do it. And then the next time something similar presents itself, you're about to do something, and the momentum of that habit continues to unfold. And so if happiness is a collection of good habits, I think it's important before we talk about communication to look at how the way we think and how we form our motivations or intentions to act are also habits. And when we're talking about speech today, I think what's really important is looking at, what do I mean when I say what I say? What's my motivation? Right? How present am I for this conversation? These are some things we'll talk about. How am I understanding what I'm hearing? And what are maybe some of the filters in which I'm understanding what I'm hearing through? So some of the most meaningful things that I've ever experienced in my lifetime have been things that people have said to me. If you were to ask me, like, point out a couple really meaningful moments in your life, they inevitably involved something that someone had said. You know, there have also been some moments of kind of nonverbal communication where someone did something for me that was very meaningful. But oftentimes it's something someone said. Some of the most harmful experiences I've ever had in my life have come from things that people have said. Some of the most harm I've created in my life has come from things that I have said. So it's important to look at, if we're talking about our intentions, the movement of the mind to do or to say something in this example, we've got to look at how skillful are we being with our speech? What is the impact of our speech? One of the things just to know is that we talk, we communicate, beyond talking, we communicate a lot. Think today about all the people you've talked to in person. I had a very isolative day, so my wife, my baby who didn't talk back to me, I think maybe a couple people when I was on a walk. But think about it, who did you talk to in person today? Even if it was just a hello or an exchange. And then think about all of the communication, like from our devices. So if we add that to the mix, my pie chart just went way up. I sent a couple DMs, a couple text messages, a couple emails. And then if we think about the communication of as an exchange, like what about all the things that I've read? Right? Today. And then if we think about how we talk to ourselves, the inner dialogue, the inner voice, in our mind. This is a form of communication that has a big impact. Right? So we're communicating all day long, but we're not always aware of the impact and the ways in which we communicate. So this is just like a whole area, and hopefully this doesn't feel overwhelming as a mindfulness practice, but hopefully it feels like a very accessible way to start to change something because it's so available. Ways that we communicate. There's kind of two categories. There's self-talk, right, and communication with others. Communication with others includes verbal and nonverbal. There's a lot of research on how much our brains pick up in facial expressions and in nonverbal communication. So that can be just a really interesting exercise. If you stripped everything else down and just thought about, like, as you look at people, what your inner reaction is to appearance, even, right? And then we look at things like nonverbal gestures, like handshakes, hugs, high fives, some of the ways that we choose to dress ourselves, postures, distance between, race, prejudices and appearance. You know, the idea of what's attractive and unattractive, right? This can go into a lot of ways that communication has an impact on us. Verbal speech, verbal communication through talking, but also through writing, email, text, right? The ways that we communicate are very vast these days. So communication is really everything. I think that's the point. Communication is everything. It's everywhere. And if you make one small change to your communication pattern, it's going to have a dramatic effect. You know, if we start to make one small change in one area in which we communicate, it can have a dramatic effect. And hopefully, as I talk about some of the ways we communicate and how to work with it, just think about different ways we can adjust our communication. So where do we start? First thing I like to talk about is mindful listening. So that's why I kind of preface this with, if we make one small change, it can have a dramatic effect. I think this is the area, for me, that if I pay more attention to it, it has a pretty dramatic effect. Right? How often am I really listening? How often am I really present and engaged in the experience that's being communicated? Mindful listening, we can kind of look at it in three areas. One is attunement. And attunement means, am I tuned into what I'm hearing? Traditionally, attunement means eye contact. But I think it also means just directing our focus and our attention into the experience. The second is impact. How am I affected by what I'm hearing? And the third is understanding. Am I clearly comprehending what I'm hearing? Or how am I translating what I'm hearing? So these three areas, attunement, impact, and understanding. Attunement's about being present. Impact's about feeling connected to the conversation and what's arising emotionally. And understanding is the information that you're hearing. I feel like listening could ease at least half of the suffering in my communication habits, right? It just makes us more effective, right? It gets us on the same page. And listening is kind of like a way of orienting to having a conversation. Like, we always think we're listening, but listening is something that you've got to intentionally do, right? To some degree, I think it passively happens because our ears, our brains are so brilliant, they translate all of these vibrations into sounds and then into words and then into perceptual thoughts, right? But we're not always actually like tuned into that experience. Why mindful listening is important, it enables connection, right? Because we communicate in order to communicate something, right? These are moments to connect. Why am I talking? Because I want to connect around something. I want to see how what I'm saying impacts you and how your understanding of what impacts you and what you're hearing may impact me. So it enables connection, also enables internalization, right? It helps us store information. It's funny, sometimes my memory gets the best of me, and I do these groups outside of here on mindfulness and emotional intelligence, and sometimes I'll do the same group 2 weeks in a row on accident. And then I'll remember it like halfway through. I'll be like, fuck, I talked about this last week. But inevitably, almost no one notices. And someone will come up to me and be like, dude, what you shared today was amazing. And I'm like, I literally did the same fucking group last week. And my groups have like visuals too. So it's not like just words coming out of my mouth. They're like pictures and images. Right, so mindful listening also helps us internalize, right, and store what we're doing. That's why repetition is actually a good thing, because we can't store everything we hear. Right? So hearing something over and over again, this is kind of the basis of the Dharma talk, really. You know? We're all saying the same thing every week. Everything changes. When we resist change, we suffer. All right, that's it. But how we hear that, right, and when we're ready to hear that, or where we're at in our lives when we hear that, helps us to internalize it if we're listening. Also, mindful listening enables us just to be more effective, to be on the same page, right? So attunement, am I tuned into what I'm hearing? One way to practice this is spending more time just checking into your body, right? To feel your feet on the floor, to observe and to notice kind of what's happening in the internal experience. Something that's really fascinating to watch in mindful listening when you're in a conversation is how much you get preoccupied during the conversation. You know, like I'm already on my way out the door and this person's talking to me. You know, or my boss has one more thing to say, and I'm not even listening to this thing. And so that's fine. It's not about right or wrong or judging. It's just very interesting to notice the preoccupations that come up and to check back in, right, just to kind of bring awareness in the moment into the body to observe those kind of contracted feelings. The second, impact. How am I affected by what I hear? So what comes up as you listen? Are you attuning to your own thoughts, feelings, and emotions? You know, investigating, sometimes this can be really fascinating. Where are these feelings coming from? Are they coming from what I just heard? Or are they coming from a translation of what I just heard? You know, from what that means to me, what that person said. You know, because we interpret experiences based upon past experience. We know that about how human consciousness works. Our perception is basically a storage bank of previous experiences. So you reference your present experience from previous experiences. So we listen to a present experience based on previous experiences. And we are often reacting from that emotional place of our previous experiences. Here's the beautiful thing. A lot of times, they're right. A lot of times they're right. Most of the time, actually. They call this procedural memory, right? We tend to have these kind of impulses to act automatically based upon previous experiences, and most of the time they're right. Someone cuts you off in traffic, emotion arises, slam on the brake, feeling of anger. So when we're listening, these same kind of emotional experiences can come up, and we can just tune into the impact. And then last, but probably most important, after we attune and notice the impact, also observing, what am I hearing? Am I clearly comprehending what I'm hearing right now? We often filter speech through our own perceptions, beliefs, worldviews. They talk about the confirmation bias a lot in psychology, how we often listen to what we already believe. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people about meditation where they're explaining a whole different way of practicing meditation, and I'm trying to be like, yeah, that's not what I practice, and them still thinking, that's exactly what I'm doing. Like, man, I was visualizing this, like, river, and I was floating down the river. It's like, that's not what I'm talking about at all. We're not on a river. We're in the body. We're in this present experience. And they're like, yeah, totally. My body was on the river. You know, it's like, all right. You know, we have these kind of misunderstandings all the time. And so am I clearly comprehending what I'm hearing? Here's a pro tip on how to practice understanding better. Therapy 101. Y'all, this works so well and will help foster so much connection in your relationships. If you say, after someone just said something, if you say, let me hear if I'm understanding you right. You just said, and you repeat back what you heard. Let me see if I'm hearing you right, and you repeat back what you said. What this does is it helps people, and you can do it in an authentic way, right? I'm not a very big fan of authenticity because I feel like sometimes shit just doesn't feel natural and it doesn't matter. Be inauthentic, but practice it because it can be really interesting. And what I've noticed is when I reflectively listen, that's what they call that, when I reflectively listen, people know that you want to understand them. People know that you want to understand them. I saw this modeled very beautifully by a fellow Dharma teacher, I won't name her, at a retreat. She was staff on the retreat, and at the end of the retreat, she had to ask people for donations, which is customary at the end of a retreat. And there was a yogi, a person that was on the retreat, I have no clue what was up his ass, but he was just like digging into her. And she stopped and she said, let's say his name's Bill. She said, Bill, I really want to understand you here. And she repeated back what she thought he was saying. And she did this like two or three times. And she did it in such a patient way. She's like, I'm really trying to understand you. And for me, I was just getting frustrated. I was like, this guy needs to just shut up. But eventually I saw him like soften and soften and soften until he said, you know, I'll talk to you about it later, right? And we were able to kind of move on. So attunement, impact, understanding, mindful listening. Now I want to talk just a little bit about some guidelines that the Buddha offered and just some other guidelines around how we should practice wise speech. And the thing that I love about the Buddhist teachings on ethics, or sila, is they're called training precepts. So one of the training precepts is I have the Pali in my head. It's, I vow to undertake the training to refrain from causing harm with my speech. I like to put it as being divisive, manipulative, harsh, or dishonest in my speech. So the interesting thing about training precepts is they're a mindfulness practice. The Buddha wasn't interested in legalist ethics, which is this idea of sinfulness and righteousness. He wasn't interested in conventional morality. He was interested in what Kohlberg calls post-conventional morality, not that interesting of a word, but basically this idea that ethics are practiced situationally and should be taken into account based upon the present experience. So how we should engage and what's honest and dishonest changes depending upon what we're doing in the moment. And so as a training precept, what we're being invited to do is to take this on as a practice. The first practice in training in wise speech is to practice abstaining from false speech. We're saying something that's untrue. To abstain from slanderous speech, which is kind of defaming someone or, you know, gossiping. We should abstain from harsh speech and abstain from idle chatter, what we might call chit-chat. This fourth one is mostly for the monks. When you take people's phones away and sex and meals and you just give them robes and say, okay, meditate all day long, they get to talking. And so it can kind of be distracting. And so I think the Buddha was like, y'all need to stop talking so much. Get your shit done. Go into the meditation hall and meditate. Right? Because sometimes our talk is just kind of this neurotic. I'm very guilty of this. I'm the neurotic type of person. I talk just to talk. I love to talk. I'm like kind of addicted to talking. I'm one of those people that if you like talking and I like talking, we'll talk together for like 3 hours and I won't notice 3 hours just went by. All right, so this is that kind of idle chatter that you got to watch out for. So abstaining from false speech, abstaining from slanderous speech, abstaining from harsh speech, abstaining from idle chatter. One really helpful tool that the Buddha encouraged to help us to check in around our intention and communicating is to ask ourselves the question, is what I'm saying in this moment true? Is it useful? Is it timely? And is it kind? Is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? Is it kind?
What was the last word?
Kind. So this is interesting because trying to have speech that kind of works with all four of these criteria is really hard to do sometimes. Sometimes I can say something that's true, but it's harsh. You know, these people that pride themselves and saying they're brutally honest. Key word here, brutal. Why do you want to be brutal? Can you just be honest and work on the brutal part? Right? So it's kind of like a way to kind of inquire and say, hey, can I be honest here, but I don't have to be brutal? What's a kind way? Kindness isn't also necessarily niceness. Right, this is where we have to look at that kind of the spiritual bypass around language sometimes, that if you're trying to live a spiritual life, you're just supposed to be this really like positive, light, uplifting, nice person. You know, we'll talk about this later, but kindness isn't necessarily niceness. Sometimes kindness is just saying the word no. You know, or that's not okay with me. Sometimes I think culturally, I know for myself, someone that's a self-diagnosed people pleaser, it can be hard to just say no. It feels unkind, but if I'm actually checking in around it, I didn't say anything unkind or mean or harsh, I just said no. And then sometimes you feel like you have to give an explanation for the no. Right? So it can just be interesting, true, useful, timely, kind. Sometimes what I'm saying is true, timely, kind, but it's not useful. It doesn't really add anything. This has been really helpful for me in my talking ass in meetings with people. You know, like I always want to say something, and I sometimes just need to shut up. And I say that for myself. Like it's helpful to be like, is this useful? Does it add to the conversation? And for me, like 5 times out of 10, it doesn't. So learning to kind of like, this doesn't add anything or it's not really helpful. Is it timely? This is taking into consideration the person we're talking to, and are they ready to hear this information? Is it a good time? I also like to add to this list, true, useful, timely, kind, is it the right medium? Is this a text? Is this a phone call? Is this an in-person thing? What's the right medium to have this conversation? So, I mean, I think it just can be really interesting to even practice this a couple times tomorrow. You know, like, what if I posted this at my desk at work or set a couple reminders in my phone, true, useful, timely, kind. And then just noticed our speech and notice what our go-tos are and how we normally interact. Another one of the precepts that's not related to speech directly, but that the Buddha encouraged some investigation around is this precept to not take what's not freely offered. I feel like this can apply to speech quite a bit too. Prying, right? I feel that there is some utility and some security in privacy. You know, some people don't want to offer the thing that you want them to offer. And so learning to practice that kind of skillfulness around respecting people's privacy and asking into, hey, do you feel comfortable talking about this thing? Also, there have been some people in my life, especially when I first got clean and I was a complete mess, and I got a sponsor in 12-step recovery, and I'd just call him all the time. What milk I should buy, what laundry detergent I should buy, no shit, literally, all the time. And he was very sweet and never once told me not to, but kind of understanding like that time is a valuable resource, right? And that like I'm asking a lot of this person. My expectations were quite high. And then I would get upset if he didn't answer, or, you know. Refraining from gossip and divisive speech. I don't know why it's so fun to talk shit about people, but it is. You know? But the downfall of gossip, right, is not just the mental environment we're creating of judging, comparing, criticizing, right? It creates the self and other thing, too, where it's like, I'm better than. It's really jealousy in action a lot of the time, you know, or it's fear and insecurity, or it's, you know, what it also does is the people we gossip with are probably a lot less likely to tell us things. And we're not aware of that all the time. But think about the people in your life that gossip quite a bit. How deep are you willing to go with those people to share things about yourself? We may not consciously be aware of that, but there's this kind of like trust that's built in understanding what is ours to tell and not, you know, or what is ours to who we should talk about and not. There's a practice, I think Joseph Goldstein took it on for a whole year, of not talking about someone unless they were in the room with him, which is actually fucking crazy if you think about it. How would you talk about someone that, you know, I think there were ways he could get around it, but, you know, and the purpose behind this was just to look at how often this tendency, even in the subtle forms of gossip, or why am I talking about this person right now? What's really going on here? Importance of clarity and directness. Do we say what needs to be said? Can we mean what we say without being mean when we say it? Right, which is kind of what we talked about a little bit earlier. Socrates has a great quote. He says, I've noticed that anyone who is to form a right judgment must have three qualities: understanding, goodwill, and readiness to be perfectly frank. Right, and I've talked about this before, but if you read some of the classical philosophy in the writings of Plato about Socrates, the interesting thing is that he's so willing to stand in the conversation, to be direct about his intentions, and to try to lead with frankness. What am I really trying to say here? Get to the point. That can be just an interesting practice, not as a judgment, but like, what am I really trying to say? Can I just say what I'm trying to say? And also being able to try to practice this tendency also in spiritual communities, in the Buddhist communities, we call it the Buddhist doormat syndrome, which is a kind of another form of conflict avoidance. Not really wanting to be direct about what my needs are out of fear of rejection, you know, or of having to feel that conflict. Last time I checked, this practice is all about embracing and turning towards the difficulties in life. But we have to kind of practice. Another thing around this that's helpful is my tendency to overact or underact? Am I an overexpresser or an underexpresser? It's just good to know that about yourself, right? I used to be an underexpresser, now I'm a little bit of an overexpresser. Sometimes I need to actually kind of shut my mouth and not talk about what I need and see, if, hey, Andrew, can I just be with this person and their needs and I don't have to have all my preferences and just kind of shut up a little bit. That's for me, right? But kind of looking at our tendencies to overact or underact. You know, there's so much stuff to be said, this was a part of my other talk too, around, you know, also privilege speech and who can speak, you know, people that are educated, you know, traditionally white men that have had power that feel that they can communicate in those structures. You know, looking at inclusive speech, looking at, you know, our terms around gender, you know, how we identify ourselves, how we try to understand how people want to be identified, being inclusive in our speech. There's so much to say around this, right? So this can be a part of our discussion together too. So the last thing is being willing to engage with people that have different views and opinions. You know, for some of us, there are varying degrees of privilege around this too. For me, it's pretty safe for me to engage with people that have very different opinions than me. You know, I'm a pretty big-looking, pretty masculine-presenting. I mean, I'm not saying I'm incredibly masculine, but pretty masculine-presenting man, you know. I can have a lot of these conversations with people, and I think it's just an interesting inquiry is how much do I kind of shut myself off from people that have different views than I do? And really, how are we going to develop understanding of people if we shut ourselves off from conversations, if they're safe for us? So we've got to kind of judge that too. I have some friends of mine that have radically different views than I do that I stay in contact with. And it's just such an interesting practice. Again, it's a privilege to be able to do that because I do think that a couple of these people have pretty harmful views. You know, so it's a privileged position. But I think I kind of owe it to my privilege to stay in communication, to try to engage with these people. You know, and it can be just a fascinating way to investigate how what I perceive as harmful views are created. You know, and looking at, like, deep down in these people, there's this humanity, there's this shared place. And it's often covered by conditioning, and it's covered by a lot of things. But there's this shared place that we all come from. You know, the Buddha talks about this spiritual journey as like an uncovering of an ancient ruin, that the greed, the hatred, the delusion, the ignorance is just kind of piled on top of this ancient city. And we're like archaeological, you know, diggers. We're supposed to go into the city and uncover it. And it's hard to uncover that shared humanity when we don't look at it, when we don't engage with it. Again, if it's safe, if we can. That can just be interesting for some of us white folks, especially, like, the political discourse that maybe you're tired of, or the conversations about race, or these things that make us uncomfortable. Totally. They're so uncomfortable. And it's just gonna be an interesting thing to check out. Like, what's that discomfort like? What's it like to have a conversation with someone that has a different view around that stuff? You know, what are my views around that stuff? So these are some of my thoughts.